Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to The Realignment's daily coverage of the Ukraine crisis through specific lenses of different issues. In the past, we've done counterinsurgency, we've done sanctions. Today, we're going to focus on the intelligence community. Those of you who tuned into Sagar and my first and second discussion episodes that we're going to be doing more of in the future will know we had this huge disagreement about the intelligence community and what it means given their predictions around the invasion of Ukraine, but also bad predictions and bad calls in terms of the fall of Kabul and then also September 11th and the Iraq war, obviously, in terms of no weapons of mass destruction. So for this episode, I decided to bring on Professor Amy Ziegert from Stanford University. She has a new book out. It's called Spies, Lies, and Algorithms, The History and Future of American Intelligence. This is a really interesting book. We start with just the focus on Ukraine, what happened with the Biden administration's decision to leak the classified intelligence as to Putin's plans. But then we take a step back and look at intelligence agencies and discuss how they should or shouldn't be reformed and what their history means for the future, especially during an age when we're transitioning away from the war on terror and focused more on the great power competition with Russia and China. Lots of great stuff. Hope you enjoy this episode. Quick things. Thank you to everyone who let me know that the tip function is broken. We've corrected that in the actual link in this podcast. So if you want to send The Realignment a tip, would appreciate it. It actually just is a good signifier of whether or not this content is working for you, whether it is not working for you when no one actually tips for certain episodes. We all know which ones those are. So lots of great stuff here. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you to the Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Let's get into the episode. Amy Ziegert, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
We are discussing the topic of the history, past, present, future of the American intelligence community. But let's start with the newsiest, well, it's not newsy anymore, but the most relevant fact that's going to come to mind when people think of intelligence in Ukraine. What you refer to as a geopolitical game changer, the real-time disclosure of highly classified intelligence, what did the Biden administration do in the lead up to Russia's invasion? And why do you categorize that as a geopolitical game changer?
So I think actually we're seeing an ongoing use of intelligence disclosures in this conflict in Ukraine. So I'll start with the what did the Biden administration do in the run up? And then we're seeing them use it now with respect to China and China's position in Ukraine. So the Biden administration revealed more intelligence more quickly in more detail for a longer period of time than in any crisis in American history. It was exceptional, the detail that they provided about Russian troop movements, false flag operations. So they released information about plots that the Kremlin had to stage a phony pretext for invasion, for example, one which included actors and corpses. I mean, it's just incredible detail that the administration released. And now we're seeing ongoing intelligence disclosures with respect to China, reporting that Chinese leaders knew about the invasion and asked that it be delayed until after the Olympics, for example. So the question is, why is the administration doing this? It is an unprecedented use of intelligence in the midst of a crisis. And I think there are really three answers. The first is inoculation. So when truth gets out of the gate first, it's a great way to have to fight information warfare. And so essentially what Biden did and his team was say, don't believe what you're going to be told by the Kremlin. They're going to lie to you that they're not going to invade. And in fact, they're prepping for an invasion. And that helped rally the allies. It helped inform the world. And so it inoculated us against the deceptive disinformation that the Kremlin is used to putting out. So that's sort of point one. Point two, friction. Revealing that information caused friction for Vladimir Putin. Putin's an intelligence guy. And when we reveal what we know, he's stewing in his juices about how do the allies know? Who can I trust? What technical systems have been penetrated? And the more he has to worry about that, the more off kilter he is, the more difficult it is for him to wage his war effectively in Ukraine. So that was sort of, I think, goal number two. And then goal number three is when you reveal that kind of information, and we see this playing out with China today, The United States is making it much harder for other countries to sit on the sidelines. There's no fig leaf excuse that, oh, well, some people think this and some people think that. So the Swiss signed on to sanctions. The Swiss never signed on to sanctions, right? The Chinese are now backed into a corner. They can't claim that the Russian narrative is correct in any kind of serious way. They're going to have to take a side. So that's imposing costs on China and it's limiting maneuverability. And so that strategy is making it much more clear that you can't have it both ways, that the United States is not going to look the other way about what China is saying and doing. And so it's all of the above, the sort of diplomatic push and using intelligence to forward those diplomatic initiatives. And I think it's a new and very clever strategy.
What's interesting here is as we're looking at this conflict as it continues to evolve, you're seeing certain rules that are longstanding, aka, well, US and Pakistanis supplied the Mujahideen with weapons. That is a practice that we are obviously pursuing from a NATO perspective today. The Soviets and the Chinese supported the Vietnamese. That's an example of longstanding rules that are being played by. Why in this case does it seem like a new set of rules in terms of intelligence disclosures was just thrown in? Like, why hasn't this been done before is the way I'll ask the question.
I'm so glad you brought up those examples. So I think what we're seeing is in some ways covert action in reverse. So you brought up the, you know, we armed the Mujahideen in a well-known covert action when the Soviets invaded. And the Soviets pretended that they didn't know. And we pretended not to know that the Soviets knew. So what was the benefit of everyone pretending that this wasn't happening? It kept things from escalating into a hot war during the Cold War. So we all benefited by pretending and then letting countries do whatever they were going to do. But in this crisis, we're doing the opposite. We're removing that fig leaf so everybody knows what Russia is doing and nobody can hide. And so by escalating, we are deliberately escalating that part of the crisis to force China and other countries to take a side. So I think we're still going to see the use of covert action. We're still not going to disclose everything, and we haven't, I'm sure, with respect to Ukraine, because there's always a risk when you reveal intelligence that your sources could be jeopardized. So people could get killed and your collection streams could get ended. So you lose your capability to monitor things moving forward. So there's a risk there. But I think we're going to see both strategies playing out in the days ahead, more deliberate revelations of intelligence, but also more efforts under the cloak of covert action.
You obviously aren't going to be able to comment on the exact nature of how we discovered the intel we discovered, but part of what seemed to drive a lot of skepticism about the disclosures before the actual invasion was, how could we possibly know this much? And as we are now discovering, as this invasion goes on, it appears as if the US intel community knew more about this invasion than many parts of Russian society itself, not just at the civilian level, but even whole parts of the military. If you're a Russian conscript, it appears possible you had no idea this was basically going to happen under these auspices. So can you speak to this direction in terms of how could we possibly have categorically known as much as we've known at even a meta level?
So I think there are a couple things that are really interesting about the how did we know what, you know, what we knew. The first is that I think we've tended to think over the past few years that authoritarian regimes have an advantage. They have an advantage in intelligence. They can collect all this privacy data, facial recognition data, that the authoritarians have the upper hand and democracies are kind of on our back foot because we have freedom of speech and that enables nefarious actors to deceive at scale. But in this crisis, what we're seeing is, you know what? Democracies have advantages too. And one of the key advantages is truth. And we can get the truth to the Russian people before the Russian government. And so if you recall, you know, before Putin really had a news blackout and imposed these fines and prison sentences for people who were independently reporting, the Russian people heard two narratives. They heard the Americans say Putin's going to invade, and they heard Putin say he wasn't. And they now know that Putin was lying to them. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And then the second part of your question is about, you know, we've gotten so many things wrong and, you know, how did we know what we knew in this case? And I think often we don't understand that intelligence successes and failures can often look the same. So imagine all these intelligence disclosures had led Putin to decide not to invade. The intelligence would have been right. and it would have been effective, but we'd be talking about yet another intelligence failure. We said he was going to invade, and in fact, he didn't. And that raises a really important point about intelligence, which is intelligence is about warning a lot of the times. And if intelligence warns and a bad action doesn't happen, it could mean that the intelligence was erroneous or that it was effective. And the revelation of that intelligence to policymakers caused that bad event not to happen. So we need to be a little more careful about labeling things intelligence failures or successes. Some things were clearly failures, like Iraq WMD. But often, success and failure is hard to tell apart.
And this is interesting. We'll get to exactly what constitutes the intelligence community in a second. But let's just talk about what the intelligence community, when they offer information, what are they saying of that information? So for example, during our discourse on this podcast, oftentimes listeners would bring up, why are you praising the CIA? Didn't they estimate that the CIA, that not, so not just Iraq, but didn't they estimate that Kabul could hold out for 12 months? It fell in less than 6 weeks. So what is the difference between a, let's say, analysis and prediction and any other words that should differentiate different claims that an intelligence analyst is making?
So I hope that listeners will walk away with at least one thing from our conversation, which is intelligence is a lot harder than we might think it is. So, you know, why didn't the intelligence agencies predict the fall of Kabul, for example? That's a moving target. And so our actions on the ground hastened the fall of the Afghan government, right? So a prediction at one, or an assessment at one point in time, is only as good as the policies that then result. So it's not a crystal ball where we say the government of Afghanistan will last until X. What we do on the ground affects what the Afghan government can do, and it affects its longevity. And so you can understand how an assessment might be correct at one point in time and then be quickly outdated by events. So that's, I think, point one. I don't want to be seen as too much of an apologist, though, for our intelligence agencies. It's clear if you look beneath the covers, right? Pentagon intelligence agencies were much more optimistic about Afghanistan. And in part, I think it's because they were grading their own homework, right? The CIA was much more skeptical about how long the Afghan government could sustain itself. And so all agencies are not created equal. And I think when you have a structure where you're grading your own homework, you're more likely to have failures. So I think those sort of contextual pieces are really important to bear in mind when we talk about, you know, how can we get it wrong and how do we think about success and failure?
And the key thing is, if we have sources indicating Russia's plans to invade, that is different than an analytical prediction as regards to the length of time that Kabul could survive without a U.S. troop presence. So I think it's just important to delineate between, is that a correct way of delineating between these different categories?
So I think it's really useful to think about intelligence as really a function of a few things. Number one, what information are you collecting? How credible do you think it is? Some information is human sources, some information is technical sources, but information itself, as we know from any endeavor, is open to multiple interpretations. So you could have satellite imagery, as we did with Russian troops on the border of Ukraine. That doesn't tell us what Putin's thinking. It just tells us that troops are on the border. Is he bluffing? Is he negotiating? Or is he preparing for an invasion? We don't know. So even something that looks like it's a smoking gun piece of intelligence is almost never a smoking gun. So there's that collection piece. Then there's the analysis piece. And the analysis piece gets to, how credible do we think that information is? How time sensitive is that information? And what are the possible interpretations of that information? The same thing can mean different interpretations to different people. And so rarely do you have uniform consensus that this is what the intelligence means. And if you do, you should be worried, because it means that you haven't asked the toughest questions about the intelligence that you're getting. So it is those two pieces, the collection piece and the analysis piece. And then I'd add the third, which is policymakers have to decide what to do with that assessment. They may decide to ignore it, discount it, listen to it. And so what they do with that information could lead to a different outcome.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the policymaker aspect, because you get at this tension in the book where oftentimes there's a perception that intelligence analysis, predictions, et cetera, are actually a part of the policymaking process in a way that they aren't necessarily. So if you're, and once again, as you've made clear, the intelligence as regards WMDs in Iraq was obviously not correct, but that bad intelligence is wrapped up within the George W. Bush administration's case for going into Iraq. So it's hard for people to look at the CIA and disentangle itself from the policy process there. So can you just really delineate between where does the collection and the analysis separate from the policy process, the decision of we have this information, we now wish to invade Iraq?
So, yeah. So, you know, there's how the process should work, and then it's a little blurrier with how it actually works. So intelligence officials are not supposed to advocate any policies. Their job is to go in and to say, Mr. President, this is our assessment of the situation on the ground. They are not supposed to say, and therefore we recommend that you do A, B, and C. They are not supposed to cross that line and recommend policy. Now, most intelligence leaders stay on that side of the line. But policymakers will tell you, and I had this conversation with Condi Rice at a book event just a couple of weeks ago, and she said, you know, it's not as straightforward as you and intelligence officials lay it out. And she, as she put it, what intelligence officials choose to analyze, what they choose to put into the president's daily brief, which is a daily, highly classified briefing of major issues around the world, that is agenda setting for policymakers, right? Pay attention to this danger, not that danger. So even though intelligence officials don't come in and say, we think, Mr. President, you should invade Iraq or you should funnel weapons to Ukraine, what they choose to emphasize in terms of threats in their analysis absolutely plays a role in the policy space. So it's in reality, it's a little more murky than I think we would make it out to be.
And we keep amorphously referring to the intelligence community, aside from just referring to it as the CIA, because obviously it's much bigger than that. Can you just actually lay out who the players are that comprise this broad community?
Sure. I mean, everyone knows the CIA. It's the agency that we see in the movies most often. It's the best known. But there are 18 different agencies in the U.S. federal government alone that collect and analyze intelligence. And collectively, they're called the intelligence community. And they're led, I should say, you know, organized, led by the Director of National Intelligence. And that's a relatively new position that was created after 9/11, because the CIA before then was supposed to be the CIA, and it was supposed to coordinate across all these other agencies. And the CIA director really could never do that, both of those jobs well. So we have a Director of National Intelligence that oversees the whole community, 18 different agencies, and the vast bulk of those agencies and the vast majority of the money and the capabilities reside within the Department of Defense. So they're Pentagon intelligence agencies.
And an example of that, for example, would be like the geospatial intelligence. Is that like an example of a Pentagon one? Can you explain? Because that's the definition of one, which I applied for internships back in college. So I've heard of the Geospatial Intelligence Agency, but that's an example of one of these 18 agencies you wouldn't necessarily. Could you explain what that one does?
Yes, you have now identified one of the least known of those agencies. I'm so glad you know about it. So the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency does, for lack of a better term, intelligence related to the Earth. So you think about things that require measurement relative to the Earth. Think of satellite imagery, for example. They do that kind of intelligence. That's not the full range of what they do, because it's not just images. There are other sensors, right? So radio frequencies and the rest. But they engage in collecting and analyzing intelligence that often revolves measurement in relation to the Earth and often involves satellite capabilities. So that's one. Another agency that people have heard about, the National Security Agency. That's an agency that's also inside the Pentagon, which means it really answers mostly to the Secretary of Defense. The National Security Agency collects and analyzes foreign signals intelligence. I emphasize the word foreign, right? They're not allowed to tap your phone calls with your grandma. There are lots of legal restrictions that prohibit the NSA from doing that. But they do things like code making and code breaking. So our nuclear codes are protected by work that the NSA does. and they intercept foreign emails, foreign phone calls, and other kinds of signals communication. So they're a big agency. They're notoriously secretive. NSA, they joke, stood for no such agency for years because no one wanted to acknowledge that they existed. So that's a big agency. And then every military service has its own intelligence agency. The State Department has a small but mighty intelligence unit called INR. They do great work. The Treasury Department has one. The Energy Department has one. The Department of Homeland Security. And then, of course, there's the FBI within the Justice Department. It is a wide-ranging set of agencies.
This may be an obvious question, but this seems far too big. I think my reaction, for example, State Department, that actually makes a lot of sense. CIA, obviously, but why can't the Geospatial Intelligence Agency be a wing of the CIA? Like, why does there have to be 18 different agencies? Like, once again, let's shuffle the Pentagon ones aside a bit, because that makes a lot of sense. But why are there so many agencies?
So there are big debates about why do we have so many and could we streamline? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? The argument in favor of so many agencies is that intelligence needs to be tailored, that specialization, just like in any company, for example, specialization can be a real benefit. So there's specialization of collection approaches or disciplines. So human intelligence requires special tradecraft. It's different than technical collection, for example. So there's an argument to be made that you need dedicated agencies that develop expertise on how do you analyze satellite imagery, right? How do you analyze whether a human source is being honest with you or not about a piece of information? So there's that specialization of collection discipline. And then there's also an argument in favor of tailoring intelligence for specific customers. So Navy intelligence is focused on things that are important to the Navy. Those are different things often than what may be important to the Army, for example, or to the Coast Guard. So that's the argument in favor of having tailored, specialized intelligence. But of course, the downside of these far-flung agencies, you're right, it's a lot of agencies. It's a really big bureaucratic behemoth. Coordination is really a problem. And coordination was the principal failure that I think led to 9/11, that these agencies did a very bad job at coordinating within themselves and then between each other. And the more agencies you have, the harder it is to coordinate them all. So, and the reason why we've had this accretion of agencies over time is a political reason. Whenever there's a big intelligence failure, the natural inclination in Washington is, let's create a new agency to solve that problem. Looks like you're taking big, bold action. Looks like you're dedicating talent to it. That's what happened with the CIA. After Pearl Harbor, we got the CIA. After 9/11, we got the Director of National Intelligence and many other agencies. But of course, the problem is when you create more agencies, if the prime problem is coordination, you may have exacerbated that problem by creating yet another agency.
Speaking of politics, something I'm curious about, something we talk about on the show a lot is this idea, not our idea, obviously, but this fact that we live in an increasingly low trust era. So any big institution is going to face an incredible amount of skepticism from the public. And this seems to be a problem that's exacerbated in the intelligence community side, because by the nature of these agencies, they're supposed to be shadowy as a pejorative, but separate, opaque, not quite clear. How have these agencies responded to this dynamic in your telling?
Well, in the book, I trace intelligence history from George Washington to the present day. And one of the enduring themes that I talk about is this tension between secrecy, which agencies need to do their jobs, and accountability, which we have to have in a democracy. And that trust factor that you mentioned is so important. And we've seen it really erode over time. And I think part of the challenge is that our intelligence agencies are in a world now where they have to be more transparent about what they do. Lots of information is openly available now, and they have to deal with the public, not just people with security clearances, voters, for example, who need intelligence about foreign election interference. They have to get out of their secret crouch because it's an unnatural act for secret agencies to engage in the public domain. But they have to do it to generate that trust, to inform the American people about what they are doing, what they're not doing, and why. And Congress has to play a pivotal role in that too. And so the Congressional Oversight Committees are the best ambassadors to reassure or or notify and warn the American people that we're seeing in these classified briefings what's going on. And we think the intelligence agencies need to be reformed or need to be applauded or need to be fixed. Congress has to play that role. No one else can do that like Congress can. And they've always struggled to perform that oversight function.
And something I'm wondering about, you hinted at this earlier when you talked about autocracies and intelligence, but if you're referring to the transparency of democracy, generally speaking, are autocratic countries better able to pursue intelligence-related tasks? So if you're the KGB or you're whatever the Chinese version of the CIA would be, like, are you able just to prosecute your task more effectively when there is no expectation of openness and just response, or let's just say grandstanding related accountability?
Yes and no, right? So on the one hand, you look at the streets of Beijing with all the surveillance cameras, right? An autocracy can perform much better at understanding what's going on in its streets, preventing foreign intelligence services like the American intelligence agencies from recruiting assets on the ground in Beijing. It's a lot harder to do that in Beijing because of all of the surveillance technology that the Chinese Communist Party has. So in that sense, there's an advantage, but they're also at a disadvantage in some key respects. So, you know, when you think about why do people in foreign countries risk their lives to spy for another government like the United States? Why do they do it? And the answer a lot of the time is because we believe in America, right? So that democratic, the democratic values, the democratic appeal, one of the most valuable assets we had in the Soviet Union in the Cold War is a guy whose code name was Top Hat. He provided incredible intelligence about a range of things. And he was executed for what he did on behalf of the United States. And he never asked for a penny for what he did. He did what he did because he believed in democracy and he believed in our country. So in that sense, I think we have an advantage in the intelligence battleground, that the allure of what we stand for enables us to recruit foreigners to share intelligence about what's going on outside the United States with American intelligence officials.
Actually, speaking of Top Hat, I crossed that part of the book. Could you actually tell that story? Because it's actually the perfect example of the combination of high ideals like you referred to, but also the very mundane, very basic screw-ups that led to his death. So if you wouldn't mind telling, I think it's a useful anecdote.
So, you know, what happened with Top Hat was, you know, there's an old saying that it takes a mole to catch a mole. So often our biggest successes and failures in counterintelligence involve penetration by foreign services. And in this case, Top Hat was revealed because there was a mole inside the United States spying on behalf of the Russians. And his name was Aldrich Ames. And Rick Ames, was a very high level CIA officer, and he did it for the money. He also did it for ego. He these motives are often mixed. And so he ended up, his betrayal of these secrets to the Russians resulted in the deaths of at least 10 of our assets on the ground, and Top Hat was one of them. And interestingly, so Ames was, should have raised a lot of red flags. He was a terrible performer. He was spending a lot of money that was living beyond his means as a government employee. That should have been a red flag. He drove Jaguars to work. He wore expensive clothes. And he was drunk a lot of the time. And he was so drunk, his Russian handlers told him he needed to stop drinking because he wasn't even betraying the United States very effectively. So there were all these warning bells that went off with respect to Ames. And interestingly, like, why didn't the CIA notice? Why didn't they do anything in time? And part of the answer is, once you're on the inside and you've gone through that security clearance process, you're inside the circle of trust. And so there's a natural inclination to believe that insiders wouldn't possibly betray you. And so, I recount in the book, I interviewed Jim Olson, who was the former head of counterintelligence at the CIA, who worked with Aldrich Ames. And he told me every day, he is haunted by the fact that he didn't do more to stop Rick Ames. Like, he has lived with that counterintelligence failure, the trusting too much, for every day of the rest of his life.
And that example, and once again, I can't recommend the book enough. There's you you do a good job of intersecting, you know, these stories with the more analytical parts, but that example comes to mind this almost technocratic question of how much failure in our intelligence agencies result from just bad policies. So, for example, in that story, they weren't searching people anymore when they had been searching people before that. So that is a situation where, okay, fix, let's search people. So how much of our failures can be related to technocratic things like that versus when you try to make predictions, analyze information, deal in human lives in a complicated Cold War situation, you're going to have screw ups, successes, failures, whatever. What would you say the balance could be between those two ends?
So I think when you're talking about counterintelligence, it's the policies really do make a difference, because what you're trying to do is detect anomalous behavior as an early warning indicator. And if you don't have policies in place to do that, you're going to leave yourself vulnerable to lots of breaches. So I think in that sense, a lot of it has to do with making sure you have tripwires and consistent policies, to not so that you're spying on each other all the time, because you have to have enough trust in your colleagues, but so that you can detect when something seems that it's not quite right, that it doesn't make sense, it's anomalous.
Jaguars in McLean, Virginia is an example of that.
Exactly. How is he able to afford his lifestyle on the government salary he has? That should have been a tripwire. But on the analysis side, it really is a lot about how do you mitigate the worst cognitive biases that we all have. I don't mean political bias, like we favor one administration over another, but all of us are imperfect processors. And we see this playing out right now with March Madness. Who did you put in your bracket? Who's going to win? We have optimism bias, right? The teams that we like the most, we put in the bracket, or we discount negative information that we hear about teams and we believe positive information. These same kind of cognitive traps affect analysts and intelligence. And so a lot of the work inside the community in terms of training and policy is about how can we mitigate those natural risks that humans face, because we're just not perfect processors. So having devil's advocates or red teams that take the contrarian view, if there's a piece of intelligence analysis, that's something that happened after 9/11, the CIA created red teams to scrub intelligence. So in the hunt for bin Laden, for example, once they amassed a trove of intelligence, there was a red team assigned to scrub every piece and say, well, what else could it mean? And what do you think if it's not him, or do you think it's him? So you get new eyes on the same pieces of information. So those are all very useful to try to reduce the risk of error. But I'll tell you something an intelligence official once told me. He said, if we're getting everything right, we're not asking hard enough questions, right? That the really tough questions have no clear right answers. And you have to accept that you're going to have a failure rate, because if you're not failing, you're not asking the tough stuff.
You know, that's interesting, because something I'm wondering about, so let's say you're an intelligence agency, you're asking for funding, you're asking for a budget. What is your claim as to what your abilities are? So for example, part of the critique of, let's say, Kabul, Iraq wars in the public perception, you talk a lot about Jack Bauer in this book, there's this perception of, wait a second, you all are supposed to be omnipresent. You are supposed to just be correct. And when there's a gap between that reality and perception, there's a big issue. If you were to talk to, let's say, the CIA director, what would the directional argument as to how effective or accurate they can be actually be?
I think, you know, if a CIA director were saying, like, here's our value proposition,
yeah,
right? It's not that we're going to be 100% right. It's that we're going to reduce the uncertainty so that policymakers can make better decisions. You can't eliminate that uncertainty. Nobody knows what Vladimir Putin's going to do. Vladimir Putin may not know what Vladimir Putin is going to do. He could change his mind. But we can reduce the uncertainty and better calibrate what the scenarios could be, so our policies are better prepared and more effective. So, you know, there's something called the wrong side of maybe fallacy. And the idea is, if a weather forecaster says there's a 30% chance of rain tomorrow, and it doesn't rain, right? Or there's a 30% chance of snow and it doesn't snow, you think, wow, they were really wrong, right? Or if you say, you know, it's something that is low probability is not zero probability. So if we say it's unlikely that Putin will invade Ukraine, he could, right? Those low probability events still happen. But we tend to think it's yes or no. We fail or succeed at intelligence prediction with pinpoint accuracy. And the reality is it's much more nuanced than that.
And once again, like you said, it's not possible to get into Putin's head on a couple different levels, but how do you think his background as an intelligence officer has shaped him? Like we haven't, I think JFK was in naval intelligence for a hot second there, but before he went out to be a PT boat commander. But do we actually have any senior officials in the American government who've been intelligence officers?
I mean, the one that most readily comes to mind is former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, who was a career CIA analyst who really cut his teeth on the Soviet Union. And so he was, you know, that was his career before he went and went on to be CIA director, and then he went on to be the Secretary of Defense. But you're right, it's unusual. And Putin, as a former KGB careerist, I think is naturally very suspicious. I think you can see that sort of paranoia. He doesn't trust people. You can see it physically in the photos of him. He's very suspicious of COVID too. So he doesn't meet with anyone around the table unless they're really far away. And so he tends to see conspiracies everywhere, and he doesn't trust pretty much anything. One of the questions with Ukraine right now is, you know, it's awfully hard to speak truth to power and tell policymakers things they may not want to hear in democracies. Mm-hmm. But imagine you're an intelligence officer telling Vladimir Putin that his assumptions about being greeted as a liberator in Ukraine might not be accurate, right? You can imagine how much more difficult that would be with him, given how he punishes people and given his own confidence that he's his own best intelligence officer. So I think it makes him particularly distrustful, and that makes him particularly dangerous for the world because he may not be getting accurate information. And if he gets it, he may be more likely to discount it.
I'm glad you used the word punishment because it brings to mind a critique that folks will use in this context. Hey, for example, who was punished for the failures in Iraq when it came to intelligence predictions? Who was punished for the, once again, we've talked about it, but these are examples people use, the bad predictions in Afghanistan over a 20-year period. How should we, in a democratic society where there are career appointees, political appointees, how should we think of this idea when it comes to punishment around wrong calls, given how amorphous these spaces are?
So I think in the policy domain, the punishment and reward really comes at the ballot box. So if Americans don't like the policy direction we're taking, regardless of the cause, whether it's bad intelligence or bad policy, we elect new leaders, right? That's the ultimate remedy in a democratic society, is we elect different leaders to lead us. But inside the intelligence community, it's a lot more challenging because often these massive failures aren't the result of one person screwing up in a big way. You can't pin the blame on one leader or one analyst or one collector. They are more often organizational failures, systemic failures. We talked earlier about organizations not being able to share information very well or coordinate very well. And that can be unsatisfying from a punishment perspective. But what we really want is just to fix the problems so that our agencies do better the next time. And, you know, I'm an organization theorist, so I always see organizational problems at root rather than individual leadership failures as the cause. And I've often argued you could have put Superman in charge of the CIA and the FBI before 9/11, and Superman would not have stopped that terrorist attack. Why? Because there were deep-seated organizational problems in both of those agencies that caused them to fail to adapt to the end of the Cold War and the emergence of a new threat. I'll give you one example. The FBI declared terrorism its number one priority 3 years before 9/11, 3 years. But if you looked at where the FBI budgets were going on 9/11, 94% of FBI personnel were working other issues. Only 6% of people in the FBI were working on counterterrorism on 9/11. So it got the threat right, but didn't deploy the resources to match the threat. And there are lots of reasons why that is, but it was essentially a bureaucracy that couldn't adapt fast enough. Was there one person to blame? No. the whole organization failed to adapt fast enough. And again, I realize that's unsatisfying to many people, mm-hmm. but the goal again is to rectify these organizational problems, not that's a holding of accountability that leads to improved performance.
And to your point around how it works in a democratic system, the response to the Iraq decision was it wasn't George Tenet, the CIA director, who decided to invade Iraq. It was George W. Bush. So if you are looking to punish or you disagree, vote for John Kerry in 2004, because that's the underpinning of the system here. I like the way you phrased the transition from the post-Cold War period to the era of counterterrorism of 9/11. It seems like right now, and why we're doing this series, is we are, at least for now, knock on wood, transitioning away from this terrorism-centric focus, and we're pivoting to this great power competition, US, China, Russia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What would you say is your assessment of like the state of the intelligence community, given this transition? If we have 6% focused on counterterror, how much of that is focused on counterterror now relative to competition with the FSB or the CCP?
So I'd say, you know, I can only glean what I can from the outside looking in. I don't know the full story, what's going on in the classified world. But I'd say our intelligence community is improving, but not fast enough. So I think notable improvements, the CIA director, Bill Burns, stood up a China mission center in the past year. We didn't have one, a mission center dedicated to a specific country. That tells you it organizes the talent, it organizes the share of mind, it focuses resources on China in a way that didn't happen before. I think that's a really positive development. I think you see a lot more focus on technology also within the CIA and across the intelligence community. That's crucial. But you know, the old adage that we're always fighting the last war is true in intelligence too. So what we see is, you know, in the past 20 years, we've been so laser focused on counterterrorism that some of our improvements have actually hardwired us for the counterterror fight and prevented us from developing as fast as we could the capabilities for the great power competition that you alluded to. So, you know, the CIA has gotten very good at integrating intelligence with warfighting, for example. But the more that the CIA is engaged in paramilitary activities, the more it's hunting, the less time it can be spending gathering. And the CIA needs to be gathering more than it needs to be hunting. We have an organization that's involved in hunting. It's called the Pentagon. So this tight integration has been helpful in the war on terror, but it's sapping resources and focus from the CIA away from collecting and analyzing intelligence on other threats that only the CIA can do in its mission to prevent strategic surprise. So we need a massive realignment of focus. And I think that's underway today. But again, I think, you know, time is accelerating with the threat environment and we need to move faster.
Yeah. For this last section, there's actually a very obvious question I should have asked you much earlier. What is the American public's perception of the intelligence community right now? So you have Edward Snowden, that's an elephant that we haven't really discussed. You have, once again, the Iraq thing I keep beating to death. What is the perception right now, you'd say?
Well, I wish I had a data-driven answer for you. So I'd love to be able to say, here's my public opinion poll of confidence in the intelligence community now versus 5 years ago. So I don't know what it is right now. But I did do polling over the past several years to look at how people view intelligence, how they view critical issues like Edward Snowden, and where they get their opinions from. And what I found was, unsurprisingly, most people don't know much about intelligence at all, don't know there are 18 agencies, don't know what they are. And what they do know, they get from the movies and from entertainment. And so what I found was statistically significant correlations for people who watched a lot of spy-themed entertainment and their beliefs about aggressive interrogation techniques like waterboarding or assassinating suspected terrorists. Or whether or not they believe the NSA was lying to them in the wake of the Snowden revelations. So what I found in my research was that spy-themed entertainment had become adult education. And so a lot of people believe that the intelligence community is running rogue, that there's no oversight, that they're following your every move, that they can run roughshod on the streets of the United States. And those things are not true. By and large, they're not true. Are there errors and have there been abuses in the past? Absolutely, there have. But there are oversight regimes in place that are doing a pretty good job at making sure that those lawful boundaries are clear and that our agencies abide by them.
So let's wrap with this question. So you do a great job of just highlighting the history, especially post-World War II, of the U.S. intelligence community. And that initial history really culminates with the Church Committee, because you see during the 50s, 60s, and the early 70s, a lot of, once again, examples of overreach, examples of improper relationships between the agencies and the actual elected officials, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So two things. One, can you just basically explain what led to the creation of the Church Committee, like what the committee itself was? And then for folks who, because there are going to be a lot of them, who disagree with, I'd say, the tone you and I are taking, if they have skepticism of this relatively, it's not that you're being positive, but just this assessment, how does a democratic society go about reforming agencies, holding proper oversight, and instituting changes?
Yeah, so I'll start with the Church Committee. You know, there's the before the Church Committee period, and then there's after the Church Committee. So the Church Committee was set up in the 1970s, and it was precipitated really by great reporting by Seymour Hersh in the New York Times, who reported that intelligence agencies had illegally spied on Americans, penetrated anti-war groups in the Vietnam War and civil rights groups. There was also reporting revealing that U.S. intelligence agencies had conducted assassination plots abroad and interfered in other ways in foreign countries. And so the Congress set up special committees in the House and the Senate. The House one was mired in partisanship and didn't produce very much, but the Senate committee was led by Senator Frank Church. And Senator Church held public hearings. They reviewed thousands and thousands of pages of documents, and they cataloged a list of horrors, frankly, committed by our intelligence agencies over a long period of time. FBI, CIA, NSA, widespread surveillance on Americans, assassination plots against foreign leaders like Fidel Castro and others. And it was horrific. And so one of the things that came out of this Church Committee, well, two things. Number one, an executive order banning assassinations, right, on foreign leaders. Now, you can debate who's a foreign leader and what's an assassination, right? So there's wiggle room in that executive order, but there is an executive order that makes it illegal, and permanent oversight committees in the House and the Senate focused on intelligence. Now, have there been problems in intelligence oversight? Absolutely, there have. And for your listeners who are really skeptical, I would say, you know, we're probably not as far apart as you might think. Oversight has to be vigilant and it has to be constant to make sure that our intelligence agencies are operating according to our values, right? That if we don't continue to keep up the heat and make it clear by elected officials what is okay and what is not okay, and make sure that we know what the intelligence agencies are doing, and they don't like to share what they're doing a lot of the time because secrecy is part of their business. If we don't do that, then abuses are likely to happen again. So oversight is only as good as it is constant and vigilant. And so I think it's really important what these congressional oversight committees are doing.
Amy, this has been really great. I would love for you to shout out the book and any other recent pieces you've written that would be of interest to any listeners.
Sure. So the book is Spies, Lies, and Algorithms, The History and Future of American Intelligence. I'm starting a new class at Stanford that I'm teaching next week based on the book. Super excited about that. And I have a new piece in The Atlantic about the Biden administration's use of declassified intelligence in the war on Ukraine. So if you're interested in learning about what's going on with intelligence right now, you can check out my piece in The Atlantic.
Thank you for joining us on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.